From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, tens of thousands are displaced by Boko Haram. A look at the Libyan crisis prior to a dialogue. Anti-Semitism in France in light of the terrorist attacks.
The situation is very difficult, and the reality is, to most people in the Jewish community, what just happened is not really a surprise.
And hackers gain access to the social media sites of U.S. Central Command. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The United Nations says attacks by Boko Haram militants in far northeastern Nigeria have forced more than 11,000 people into neighboring Chad and may have displaced 150,000 overall since seizing the town of Baga and nearby villages on January 3rd. Lisa Schlein has details from Geneva.
UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs spokesman Jens Laerke tells VOA information is sketchy because Baga and the surrounding areas have been inaccessible.
The attacks there in Baga town in Borno state on the 3rd and the 7th displaced an estimated 150,000 people. That's according to the Borno state Emergency Management Agency, because independent access to the area is simply not there at the moment. So this figure has yet to be verified by the UN.
Laerke says most of the displaced are living with host families in various communities and are receiving assistance from state and local agencies, as well as the Nigerian Red Cross. The UN Refugee Agency reports 11,320 people have fled to Chad since the attack on Baga. UNHCR spokesman William Spindler says 60% of the refugees are women and children, and 40% are men.
There's also 84 non-accompanied children, and some of them are stranded on an island on Lake Chad called Kangalam Island. There's about 2,000 of them there, and UNHCR is transferring them to the mainland. This is all in Chad, and this transfer has started.
According to some reports, fighting since January 3rd has killed as many as 2,000 people, but the Nigerian military disputes this figure. The government has been conspicuously silent since the attack on Baga, but Monday, Nigerian defense spokesman Major General Chris Olukolade said at least 150 people had been killed. The UN Human Rights Office condemns what it calls the vicious, ruthless attacks against civilians by Boko Haram. Spokeswoman Ravina Shamdasani says it is likely the number of people who have lost their lives is significant.
We haven't been able to verify that. Well, what is clear is that eyewitnesses are saying, one eyewitness was talking about how when he was fleeing, he was tripping on bodies the whole way. So clearly, a large number of people were killed.
Shamdasani says the deliberate targeting of civilians is prohibited by international law. The UN agency is urging the Nigerian government to act swiftly to restore law and order. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Six Western powers have welcomed the United Nations announcement of a new round of political dialogue on Libya this week. News of the dialogue comes as the internationally recognized Libyan government is asking for military help in tackling rival militias. The six powers, the United States, France, Germany, Italy, Spain, and the United Kingdom, issued a joint statement applauding the extraordinary efforts of the UN Secretary General's special representative in organizing the talks. The internationally recognized government is based in Libya's eastern city of Tobruk. It was forced out of the capital, Tripoli, last August. A rival administration, supported by Islamist fighters, now controls Tripoli and the port city of Misrata. The two rival governments and their allied militias are battling for the biggest oil reserves in Africa. Consultant Jason Pack, head of LibyaAnalysis.com, says the country has become a major source of destabilization in the region. Pack explained the various aspects of the Libyan crisis with VOA's Mohamed El-Shenawi.
Jason, is Libya on the verge of de facto partition or a return to the transitional track is still possible?
This is a very difficult question to answer. There are some signs that we're moving towards partition, i.e. that fault lines are coming into play. Each side is struggling for the oil and trying to control its own territories. But we're not there yet. Each group claims to be the sovereign authority for all of Libya. The Tobruk government has legitimacy in an international perspective to say that it should touch Libyan sovereign assets. The Misratan-led alliance in Tripoli also wishes to dominate the whole country. Partition could only come about if a dialogue fails.
How are regional and international actors affecting the development of the Libyan crisis?
Unfortunately, international actors provide the fuel for the fire that drives the Libyan crisis. On the one side, Egypt, the UAE, Saudi Arabia provide arms, money, and political support to the Tobruk government. And they give it the hope that it can conquer Benghazi, that it can push westward. On the other side, the Qataris, the Turks, the Sudanese smuggle arms and funds for Islamist militias and the Misratin-led alliance. If outside actors would be boxed out of the conflict in Libya, Libyans would have to quickly run out of money and deal with each other to make a national unity government and return to the transitional track. Outside actors see Libya as one piece in a larger regional puzzle. They don't focus on what's really happening in Libya. And that's why they use the wrong narratives and they destabilize it.
But if the two warring sides believe that force is the only way out and they can win, how would you mediate to reach a solution?
Well, we need to have something like a mutually hurting stalemate. Because without that stalemate, each side won't agree to UN mediation efforts. They will continue to try to use arms to dominate their opponents. However, I believe that we could declare that no one in Libya has sovereignty and use a range of sanctions to box out different international actors, and then quickly the sides would run out of money and need to deal with each other because the stalemate conditions would be reached.
You're calling for a UN security resolution.
Yes.
To fix the problem in Libya. How do you think the Russians would be acting on such a resolution?
Well, first we have to call for this resolution and see if the Russians might be more pragmatic than we would think. If they turn out to be entirely destabilizing and disruptive and would veto a constructive approach, then Russia is not actually that big a player in Libya, neither is China. The West can act alone in alliance with our regional partners.
Do you see any role for the Arab League?
A huge role. The Arab League is very important. The problem is that the Arab League is divided on the Libya question. Obviously, you have Qatar on one side, and you have the other GCC countries on the other. But if the Arab League understands that the situation in Libya is destabilizing, they may give their imprimatur for actions on behalf of the international community to help the Libyan people.
How about the European Union? Do you see any role for them?
They need to be the leading players. Europe is the key player in Libya. It consumes the majority of Libyan oil. It has the majority of investments inside Libya. It's also the place where illegal migrants from Libya go. So it's the Europeans who have the most political will to do something. And Italy and France and Britain, they have the ability through the UN mechanism, Bernardino León, the special envoys such as Jonathan Powell, to try to mediate between the two sides and to invest political capital as well as human capital in trying to solve things. The U.S. is too far away. We don't have as many core interests. It's unlikely that we would make the kind of sacrifices to be involved in Libya that the Europeans will.
Consultant Jason Pack, head of the LibyaAnalysis.com site. An Egyptian appeals court today overturned a conviction on charges of embezzlement against former President Hosni Mubarak, opening the door to his eventual release from detention at a Cairo military hospital. The case will, however, be retried. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
Cheers and applause broke out in the courtroom after Egypt's highest appeals court threw out a previous ruling against former President Hosni Mubarak and his two sons on charges of fraud and embezzlement. Mr. Mubarak received a 3-year prison sentence in the case. The former president's lawyer, Fareed Deeb, smiled broadly after the decision was announced and told journalists that the ruling would clear the way for Mr. Mubarak's release. It was not immediately clear when that would be, however, and the court did not order him to be freed. Supporters of the former president waved his picture above their heads, and a group of women ululated to celebrate. Supporters of the former president waved his picture above their heads, and a group of women ululated to celebrate. One woman in the courtroom told Yom Sabah newspaper that she was relieved by the verdict and had considered the conviction unfair, both legally and on a human level. Alhamdulillah. Outside the court, on a street leading to Cairo's iconic Tahrir Square, supporters and opponents of the veteran Egyptian ruler shouted at each other and traded insults. The exchange was a far cry from the rock-throwing and fisticuffs between the two groups when Mr. Mubarak first went on trial. More serious charges of killing protesters during the January 2011 revolution, which toppled him, were thrown out after a retrial found him not guilty. But prosecutors have appealed the dismissal of charges, leading to the possibility of yet another trial. Mubarak critics believe history has already judged him. Veteran Egyptian editor and publisher Hisham Qassem tells VOA that he thinks the man who ruled Egypt for 30 years was guilty of more than just corruption, but malfeasance in office.
This man's biggest crime, apart from corruption, is incompetence. He has been a caretaker president or a chargé d'affaires for 30 years and never cared to step down. Now, in a job like yours or mine, there's always damage from incompetent people. But when you're the president of a republic, your incompetence means malnutrition, poverty, misery, etc. And what this man has inflicted upon the country is enormous.
Paul Sullivan, who teaches at Georgetown University in Washington, D.C., pointed out that Egypt's legal system sometimes seems to move in mysterious ways, but that a retrial indicates there must have been some evidential, procedural, or legal justification. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Washington has admitted it erred in not sending a top official to attend the solidarity rally in France on Sunday. At a news conference, White House spokesman Josh Earnest spoke about the decision to have U.S. Ambassador to France, Jane Hartley, and the State Department's top diplomat for Europe, Victoria Nuland, as the highest-ranking American officials to join the scores of world leaders alongside French President François Hollande.
I think it's fair to say that we should have sent someone with a higher profile to be there.
Earlier Monday, U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry dismissed criticism that neither he nor other top officials traveled to Paris.
I don't think the people of France have any doubt about America's understanding of what happened, about our personal sense of loss, and our deep commitment to the people of France in this moment of trial.
Secretary Kerry added that the U.S. has been deeply engaged and has been sharing intelligence with France from the moment the attack took place. The terrorist attacks in France included a deadly hostage drama at a kosher grocery store. Four people and a hostage taker were killed there. We spoke about the incident with Simone Rodin-Benzaquin, director of the American Jewish Committee office in Paris.
The attacker came into the supermarket, killed immediately three victims, and then held hostage several others for several hours. He had a phone conversation with several media, so his motivations were sort of explained, in which he says that he was avenging Muslims all over the world. It was actually a mixture of avenging Muslims, we have to leave us alone, there will be many others who will come. He also said that the reason why he did it is that the French did not save the people in Syria. It was sort of a mixture of unclear things. And he was then the police made an assault a few hours later and killed him. He had in the meantime, he had unfortunately the time to kill another victim who tried to grab a gun, which didn't work, and he killed him.
Is this believed directly related to it being a kosher grocery store?
Yeah, there's no doubt about it. The motivations are clearly anti-Semitic. The police have really clearly stated it. It is really in the context of a succession of events and in the context of a growing jihadi threat against Jews here in France. The president has immediately, President Hollande has immediately spoken out and said very, very clearly that this is an anti-Semitic attack directed against the Jewish community. There's no single doubt about it.
How bad is the state of anti-Semitism in France?
The situation is very difficult, and the reality is, to most people in the Jewish community, what just happened is not really a surprise. It is sort of another attack of a series of attacks that happened over the past years. You might remember that only 2.5 years ago, the terrorist Mohamed Merah killed Jewish school children in the southern city of France in Toulouse. We've had an increase of anti-Semitic acts of about 90% last year. The anti-Semitic acts that are violent are also becoming more and more increasing. We had, in terms of violent anti-Semitic acts, we had an increase of 124%. So it's really in the context of a larger situation that is extremely dangerous for the Jewish community and very, very worrying.
Are more French Jews leaving France because of their treatment there?
For a very long time, the numbers of French Jews leaving to Israel was between 2,000 to 3,000 Jews a year. This year, we've really hit a record of French Jews who left to Israel. We had 7,000 French Jews this year. It is expected that next year there will be about 10,000. With this event, who knows, there can be many more. It also, this number doesn't take into consideration those who left to other countries, to the United States, to Canada, and other European countries. The situation is very, very serious, and there are obviously, I mean, those who are leaving, but there are many others who stay, and those who stay ask themselves the question whether they have a viable future in this country.
Well, what can and should be done to improve the treatment of Jews in France?
We at the AJC and also from the French Jewish community have alerted the government for a very, very, very long time. There are many things, I believe, that can be done. First of all, security measures need to be taken in order to protect Jewish sites. There was already an increased security, but much more needs to be done. The President Hollande and the Minister of Interior have announced that they have deployed a plan where the army will now protect a certain number of Jewish sites. This could have probably been done before. Then there needs to be done very, very clear program on counter-radicalization, something that has not existed sufficiently, I believe, in France. There needs to be work that needs to be done in prisons. We have a huge problem of radicalization in our prisons. There needs to be thinking about whether to separate those who are potentially radicalizers of others. We need to be doing much more work on hate speech and radicalization methods on the internet and social media in particular. We know now that out of the 1,000 French fighters who were involved in Syria or in Iraq, many of them have actually become radicalized on the internet. So much more needs to be done on that one. And then finally, we need to be doing much more in terms of education in our schools. Young children need to learn about tolerance, about democracy, about other religions, if we want to make sure that this is not going to happen again.
Simone Rodin-Benzaquin, director of the American Jewish Committee office in Paris. Hackers claiming to support Islamic State militants Monday were able to gain access to the social media sites of U.S. Central Command, which oversees U.S. military operations in 20 countries across South and Central Asia and the Middle East, including airstrikes aimed at IS positions in Iraq and Syria. They posted threatening messages and propaganda videos as well as military documents. The Pentagon says while the accounts were compromised for about 30 minutes, no sensitive or classified information was accessed. Views the incident as a case of cyber vandalism. But the Federal Bureau of Investigation is looking into the matter. Cedric Layton is a former U.S. Air Force intelligence officer and now operates his own risk management and consulting firm. He was asked by VOA's Victor Beatty how serious he believes the breach was.
Well, it is certainly concerning from the standpoint of the fact that it impacts the message that CENTCOM is trying to send out to the Middle East, because both the English language Twitter feed of CENTCOM and the Arabic language Twitter feed of CENTCOM were hacked. Now, the key thing to know about this is that it did not affect the actual CENTCOM networks. This was solely the Twitter and YouTube accounts that are actually managed by those respective services. So the hackers did not get into the actual networks, either the unclassified or the classified networks of CENTCOM. They did not have access to true operational details or any data of that type. The data that was posted appeared to have been old data, but it was made to look as if it was relevant to operations that are ongoing at this moment. That does not appear to be the case. So it is an attempt to intimidate. It is a psychological effort, part of a psychological warfare campaign by the Islamic State or people that support the Islamic State. And it should be looked at as a serious issue, but it is not a grave threat to the national security of the United States.
Is it a precursor to something where hackers could drill deeper into CENTCOM's computer network?
It's a remote potential that could happen through a Twitter or YouTube feed. But those networks are actually separated from the classified networks and the ones that are used for operational planning. So that possibility, while it exists, is remote at this point.
Congressman Michael McCaul of Texas, who is chairman of the House Committee on Homeland Security, called it severely disturbing, quote, assaults from cyber jihadists will become more common unless the Obama administration develops a strategy for appropriately responding to these cyber attacks, including those like the North Korea attack against Sony Pictures.
There are certainly areas for concern here, and any time a Twitter account or a YouTube account is hacked, that shows that there are weaknesses within those respective services, and means that everything should be tightened according to basic authentication procedures and other things that can be done to assure the identity of the users of those accounts. But having said that, the key thing is that there has to be a differentiation between what happened with CENTCOM's Twitter account and the YouTube account versus what happened in the Sony hacking case. And those are two distinct issues. In the Sony case, the network of Sony was actually attacked, actually rendered useless and inoperable. And that is a much more severe impact than what occurred in the case of the CENTCOM Twitter account.
Layton says this latest hacking represents an evolving form of warfare in the 21st century, providing both state and non-state actors an asymmetrical advantage over their adversaries. He says such attacks will unfortunately become more commonplace over the next decade. Speaking to the Washington Post, Peter Singer, a strategist and analyst with the New America Foundation in Washington, says the hacking amounts to a public relations victory for IS, even if it was not directly involved. He says embarrassing the U.S. government is a feather in the cap in terms of pulling off something that other groups have not been able to do. On a lighter note, Pope Francis has highlighted the need for justice, healing, and unity in Sri Lanka, where he arrived today for the start of a week-long trip to Asia. The Pope spoke at the International Airport in Colombo, saying Sri Lanka needs to pursue the truth of what happened during its long civil war, and rebuilding must include a respect for human rights and the full inclusion of each member of society. The Pope was greeted by newly inaugurated President Mathrapala Sirisena, who has promised an independent domestic inquiry into wartime abuses. The 78-year-old pontiff postponed a meeting with Sri Lankan bishops after the journey from the airport in an open-top car under the hot sun took longer than expected. Pope Francis will spend 2 days in Sri Lanka before heading to the Philippines. On Wednesday, he will hold a seaside mass in the capital, Colombo, and canonize the country's first saint. The visit to Asia is the Pope's second to the region since beginning his papacy and is part of the church outreach to developing nations. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yaffe, reporting to you today, as always, from Washington.